You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme.
The strategic blunders of the West in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Caucasus have turned these parts of the world into a haven for terrorists and extremists.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani says that the fight against Islamic State cannot be won by forces outside the region as the US-led coalition continues its assault on IS targets in Syria. I'll be joined by journalist Jeffrey Kaufman and commentator James Boyes to discuss that and more of the day's key news stories from around the world. Also ahead... He gave voice to America's disenfranchised in the 1930s. Now a new graphic novel chronicles the life of Woody Guthrie. We'll also bring you some live music from the era too. And we'll check in with one of our correspondents from around the world and review the latest book releases. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before all of that, here's Paul Osborne with the latest news from around the world.
Airstrikes against Islamic State militants have targeted oil refineries under its control in Syria. Raids by the US, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are believed to have killed at least 14 IS fighters. France has carried out its first airstrikes on Iraq in almost a week, the day after the murder of a French hostage, with ministers saying the country's operations could soon spread to Syria. On Friday, British MPs will debate whether the UK military should join the operation. But Robert Fox, who's the defence editor of London's Evening Standard newspaper, says it could test Britain's depleted armed forces.
Quite ancient tornadoes working very hard, and they'll have to be renewed. This, as it goes on, which I think it will drive a coach and horses through all the defence planning and cuts and what passed for policy and strategy and foreign policy since the UK government, coalition government, came to power 4 years ago.
US officials are questioning a claim from Iraq's prime minister of an Islamic State plot to attack American subway systems. Haider al-Abadi said he had credible intelligence from captured IS fighters and suggested the metro in Paris could also be a target. But US officials say there is no evidence of such a plot. Around 300 Syrian refugees have been rescued after their boat got into trouble in rough seas off the coast of Cyprus. Most of those on board were women and children. They were picked up by a cruise ship and are now heading for Limassol, where they'll be seen by doctors. President Obama has called for an increased global response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, warning hundreds of thousands could die without greater outside intervention. Sierra Leone has announced it's extending an indefinite quarantine to cover another million people. It follows a nationwide lockdown which lasted 3 days. And one Liberian minister has warned the region is facing a race against time. Axel Addy says they need all the help they can get.
This is something that we've never experienced in our history. The challenge of dealing with this response is still being looked at and assessed, and it requires the full commitment of the international community to move very fast.
The US Attorney General Eric Holder is to announce his resignation. It's thought he will step down as soon as a successor has been confirmed. Mr. Holder is one of the longest-serving members of President Obama's cabinet, appointed when he took office in 2009. The military in Nigeria say that more than 130 Boko Haram fighters have surrendered. They're calling it a significant breakthrough after fighting around Maiduguri. The military has also claimed to have killed a man acting as the leader of Boko Haram, saying he had taken the name of Abubakar Shekau. But Nigerian political analyst Ebonolu Adegbura says it's not the first time that claim's been made.
We just don't know what to believe. Because in June 2013, Shekau was said to have been killed, whereas somebody has appeared individual and has been parading himself, so to say, as a cow. So I won't be surprised by tomorrow we may have another video of another person parading himself as a cow.
The Pope has fired a bishop in Paraguay over allegations he covered up child abuse in the United States. Pope Francis sacked Rogelio Oliveres Plano after a Vatican investigation. He had repeatedly denied protecting a priest who was suspected of sexually abusing young people in the US. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. It's 18.05, ticking towards 18.06 here in London, almost 7.06 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ut London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Our guests today are Geoffrey Kaufman of ABC News and James Boyes of King's College London. Welcome to you both. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani took to the UN's General Assembly today to outline the Iranian view of the fight against Islamic State militants in neighbouring Iraq and, of course, in Syria. Before we hear from James and Geoffrey, here is what President Rouhani had to say.
The strategic blunders of the West in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Caucasus have turned these parts of the world into a haven for terrorists and extremists. Military aggression against Afghanistan and Iraq and improper interference in the developments in Syria are clear examples of this erroneous strategic approach in the Middle East.
That was President Hassan Rouhani of Iran speaking at the UN General Assembly a little earlier. Geoffrey Kaufman, essentially President Rouhani saying to the West and particularly America, it's your fault this happened and we'd rather you don't try and sort it out.
That wasn't the quote I expected you to play, actually. There was an even more meaty quote, I think, that you might have selected. And he said, and I will quote, "Certain intelligence agencies have put blades in the hands of madmen who now spare no one. And all those who played a role in founding and supporting these terror groups must acknowledge their errors. Blades in the hands of madmen." It's a very powerful statement. And you know, essentially, he's right. I mean, this is the consequence of an ill-considered toppling of Saddam Hussein, who was a madman himself. But, you know, this naive notion that democracy would flourish and if just the bad guy was pushed away. And now look what's happened. You know, Rouhani speaks some truth there.
James Boyes, it's interesting that he's also trying to say as well that, you know, despite the fact that we've heard in the past that this idea that Iran also wants to get rid of ISIS as well or Islamic State, he's basically saying, look, not only did you make this mess, but we really don't need your help in clearing up. That's not going to help in any way.
If only that were true. It's remarkable, isn't it, Steve? We're talking here about another case of American blowback, it would seem. I'm not sure what this does for the supposed blossoming relationship between the United States and Iran. We've heard a lot over the last 2 years or so about negotiations with regard to nuclear deals, for example. I don't know whether this is going to help that in any way, shape or form. Certainly, I think if you look at the work that John Kerry's been trying to do to bring this relationship better together, I think this could have a serious implications for that. Of course, it's interesting to note, of course, that Iran has long sponsored groups like Hezbollah, for example, who aren't exactly any sort of cakewalk themselves. So the fact that we've got now the Iranians talking about allocating blame to the US in itself is no great surprise. But when you talk about this coalition that's trying to come together, it's clear that Iran wants as little to do with it as possible, despite the fact that only last week John Kerry was in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee having to answer questions about potentially allying with Iran if indeed the Americans louse it up in that part of the world.
Well, Iran just isn't prepared to talk until these sanctions, the nuclear sanctions, are dealt with. And you know, they don't want to sort of on one hand cooperate and the other hand be squeezed as they have been for the last number of years. And And it's an interesting line Rouhani's walking. I don't know that he's being so antagonistic. I think he's, you know, I think it's hard to dispute that he's speaking some truths here, and he's clearly on a kind of a goodwill or a mission to raise profile and to be heard as he travels in New York.
I mean, that's the thing, James, isn't it? That, you know, he's not. President Obama isn't going to turn around and say, oh, well, President Rouhani said some mean things about me at the UN General Assembly, so that's it, nuclear talks are off. Yeah, he's not Kim Jong-un.
He's not, thank goodness. And of course, you know, what is going to be achieved in the immediate short to long term? I mean, the question is, I suppose, to what extent is the American military enterprise in that part of the world going to have a delaying effect upon any deals that is struck with the Iranians? The idea of kicking things into the long grass is of importance. The Americans, of course, are about to have midterm elections in November. President Obama is effectively a lame duck after that. His ability to negotiate with the Iranians on any sort of deal might well become caught up in the hubbub and the sort of the playground politics of the 2016 presidential election, for example. If you look at some of the questioning that was coming out of the Foreign Relations Committee last week by people like Marco Rubio, for example, who's long been critical of this deal with the Iranians, it's clear that the Republicans want to put that deal on the table and to sort of draw, I think, clear sky thinking between what the Republicans would countenance and what the Democrats have done with regard to Iran moving forward.
I think the only thing worse for America than talking to Iran is not talking to Iran. This is the problem. And yeah, so with so many of these actors that you don't really want to be seen fraternizing with so many of these people who have such questionable or clear explicit records of ill deed, but at the same time, this just can't be done in a vacuum.
No, I agree. And then one of the challenges, I think, for any administration is that post 9/11, there was this concept that in America, you don't negotiate with your enemies, you only talk with your friends, which I think stood in stark contrast to a British approach. And I know people like Jack Straw, for example, were heavily frowned upon. And indeed, it's rumoured lost his job because he was trying to negotiate with the Iranians against the American will at that point. So I think one of the great things about the Obama administration is at least they got out of that mindset. The question is, will we return to it if, and it's a big if, the Republicans were to gain the White House in 2016.
I want to look at this coalition that the US has been trying to build, because every time the US bombs Iraq, there is, and this is now the fourth time, there is a coalition of some sorts. In 1991, you had James Baker, George H.W. Bush's Secretary of State, who was sent out to make friends within the region and build a proper coalition. You then contrast that to 2003 and the so-called Coalition of the Willing, which, to remind you, included such giants as Eritrea, Albania, El Salvador. Not quite sure what they did.
I remember when I was in Iraq meeting some of these troops, and I we were playing this game. What flag is that on his shoulder? And we were quite. Kidding! I didn't even know they were part of the coalition. Yeah. Just what skills? I don't want to make fun of small countries and their limitations, but it was a very strange. But mix.
And that was also very much. It was right. If we have two troops from this country, that counts as an ally. Now this time, President Obama was in this position, James Boyce, where he could say, when they carried out their first raids inside Syria, we've got the UAE, we've got Qatar, we've got a range of Arab allies that aren't just with us in name only. They have either given us intelligence or have taken part in this. This is a sort of slightly smarter coalition building, is it not?
Yeah, I think that let's be honest, what Obama has done is tried in many ways from the beginning of his campaign not to be George W. Bush, to look back at that presidency and say, what do I do differently? And I think, both critics and admirers of this administration would say what he's tried to do in this first instance is to go back to the model of the first Bush presidency and trying to get together a working alliance that can be clearly said to be international. Now, when he came out of the summit in Wales, of course, he was talking about a NATO-led alliance. That's fine, but that's basically still a bunch of white Western European guys. And clearly what Kerry has done is to follow the model of Jim Baker, which is to go beyond that, to bring in Arab partners so that they can now say, right, fair enough, it's NATO plus, effectively. And of course, we're expecting a vote in the House of Commons tomorrow to bring Britain on board with that.
We'll come on to that vote in a moment. But Jeffrey Coffin, when you look at this coalition, as James says, there are now, Arab countries there that they do seem to be on board. It is still very much the US doing it with with Arab support, in much the same way as in Libya, they felt that they had some cover because the Arab League had said, yes, we support this because we hate Gaddafi too.
Of course, because militarily, the U.S. is the only one that actually has the capability. But the fact that you've got Qatar and UAE and a number of other, I think it's half a dozen Arab countries as part of this, it does give them quite a lot of cover. Listen, there is a virus that is taking hold in this world of ultra extremist Islamic menace that has to be contained somehow. And it's only going to happen internally within the Arab community, within the Muslim community. It's not something that bombs and rhetoric from Westminster or the White House is going to contain. And so what Obama's doing that I think is all he can do, in a sense, is enlist these countries to say, this is your problem. You know, it's our problem, but it's also your problem. And you are hearing these interesting denunciations, which seem unfamiliar to me, James. Maybe there is some history of them, but to hear these Arab countries denouncing this kind of extremism so clearly does signal at least that they're getting the message.
Yeah, one hopes so. I think what's fascinating is the extent to which the Americans have had to go to these places and say, come on, guys, this is your battle, get involved. We can help you, we can provide air cover, but this really should be your fight. The idea that these people have to be encouraged to take the battle to ISIS is quite remarkable, I think.
Well, but the reality of this whole region is that, you know, and it's a line I've used before, is that you know, sheikhs and kings and all, they're just dictators, these guys. They're not accountable, so why would they?
Well, and also, there is the issue not just about the fact that many of these are sheikhs and dictators, but, you know, a country like Turkey, it's all very well us from the studios in London saying Turkey should do more, but we don't share a 600-mile border with Syria, we don't share a border with Iran, we don't share a border with Iraq. It's a lot harder for a country like Turkey, James,
you're quite
isn't it?
Right, and it's interesting.
And Jordan, I know, as well.
And Jordan as well.
A week or so ago, we were talking in this very studio about the role of Turkey. Would Turkey get involved, etc., etc.? And of course, Turks. There were 40 Turks at least being held by ISIS.
49 in Mosul.
49,
yeah.
A number of whom have been released in the last couple of days. Be interesting to see what implications that has. I mean, your whole questioning is this idea about the sort of Arab states getting involved. This is about political cover, nothing about military escapades at all. It's all about the semantics and the imagery of this.
Talking about political cover, if we can call it that, there is going to be a vote in the UK House of Parliament tomorrow about whether the UK is going to join in airstrikes, although there's still some doubt about sort of how much the UK's joined in already. Jeffrey Kaufman, last year we saw a vote in the House of Commons over Syria, which went very badly for the government because they recalled Parliament. It was done in a rush. There'd been no real debate about Syria leading up to then. And suddenly it was like, right, should we bomb? And lots of people were like, oh, hang on, Iraq didn't go very well. Oh, I don't know much about Syria. Maybe not. But that then
that
had.
I like the way you articulated that. That was very nice. Yeah.
Thank you. But that then had obviously a knock-on effect with the US. Barack Obama then thought, maybe I should go to Congress, and Congress were like, we should do it. Oh, you want us to what? To say it? Oh, not so sure.
You should have finger puppets while you do this, I feel.
But my point about this is, how important is it that that democracies have these debates and have these votes?
Well,
that is what separates.
First of all, having been burned once, Cameron has learned and actually phoned Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, to say, are you going to support me on Friday or
and,
no?
And do you mean it this time?
Absolutely.
And will you really follow through? And apparently he feels comfortable that he will. But Miliband had already said, in Iraq, yes, because Iraq, the Iraq democracy has gone to met with Cameron, in fact, and said that the new president and said, we need your help. So I think Miliband quite rightly says, well, you know, this is a legitimate request, whereas Syria, he has said no. So it's a very interesting thing. Those tornadoes from the UK will be watching the border of Iraq and Syria. And if an ISIL or ISIS or a member is on one side of the border, they can bomb him. But if he's on the Syrian side, they won't be able to. Listen, it's important that democracies take the use of force and military force very seriously and be accountable and use parliaments and congresses appropriately. Yeah, of course.
And it is, James, isn't it? That, you know, given the fact that, I mean, look, we go back to 2003 and obviously there was a big parliamentary debate. And it was Parliament. It wasn't, you know, as much as some people like to say Tony Blair led Britain to war. It was
no, but they lied to Parliament. Let's be clear.
Let's not get into that. Let's not reopen that one again. But the issue was there was a parliamentary vote. Do you think there is, despite the fact that there is no law whatsoever in Britain which says a Prime Minister must do that, do you think that is actually a good convention that has now begun?
I do. And I think I was happy to sign an open letter to the Prime Minister this summer calling for that. I think that whatever one thinks of David Cameron's domestic politics, I think he has tried to follow this model of bringing Parliament on board. He doesn't need to. I think if you look at what happened last summer, I believe he had a deal with Ed Miliband that went south after they'd called the vote. Don't forget, I mean, you were talking in your opening question, Barack Obama wasn't held in any way not to act just because the British Parliament hadn't done. And if he'd wanted to, we'd seen American presidents act without Congress, without Britain in the past. So it's a fig leaf, I think, to get out of something.
We'll leave it right there. Jeffrey Kaufman, James Boyes, thank you both. When we return, we'll be talking about the UN General Assembly and wondering how useful it actually is. You're listening to Midori House.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Jeffrey Kaufman of ABC News and James Boyes of King's College London. Let's head now to the subject of the UN General Assembly and look at how useful this gathering of world leaders might be. Jeffrey Kaufman, I must say, and this is partly also because I was in New York during the last month to a piece about the Security Council and how that works or doesn't work, which you can read in this month's issue of Monocle. I tend to think that despite the fact that we mock this sometimes, there's actually quite a lot of good that can happen during this week of the UN General Assembly. It's big issues are on the table, whether that's, as we heard earlier in the news, you know, President Obama convening the Security Council to discuss Ebola, whether that was discussing how to challenge ISIS, or just giving people a platform to talk. That surely is no bad thing.
Absolutely. Listen, the UN is deeply flawed. It's corrupt. It's exploited. All of those things. But the world would clearly, if we abolished the UN today, we'd have to recreate it tomorrow, just as we did with the League of Nations after the Second World War. Leaders have to talk to each other. You see Cameron sitting down with Rouhani from Iran. I mean, it's better that these things happen than they don't. So I don't think, you know, I think ultimately this is just pure logic. As flawed as it is, you know, of course, if we were to rewrite the charter now, we would make a lot of things different, including the Security Council, which is sort of caught in the Cold War in which it was born and makes no sense whatsoever. But it just is, and it's really not possible to completely reinvent the place, and so we have to make it work to the best it can, and that seems to be a noble cause.
James Boyes, I must say I do slightly miss Muammar Gaddafi and his 90-minute speeches. They're all supposed to limit themselves to 15, but, I mean, Barack Obama went over till half an hour, so, you know, if he can do it, why can't others? I saw earlier Robert Mugabe, I looked up and he was speaking. I looked up about an hour later, I think he was still speaking. And it is, you know, the fact that there are interesting characters that get to say their piece at this event. And that's surely is a good thing.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing. I mean, whether it actually does an awful lot in the big scheme of things to promote these ideas or push these ideas along is perhaps questionable. But there's no doubt that the UN as an institute is worth having. I think clearly, if you look at the Security Council and how that's operated, there's been attempts to try to rejig that, reformat it, which is probably never going to happen for various reasons. But certainly the idea of bringing the world's leaders together at the UNGA on a regular basis is a good thing. It shows, you know, know, it brings people together, it gets people talking who might not otherwise do so. And I think as soon as you put, you know, people together in the same room, it humanizes issues. And of course, you can sometimes end up with the strangest of bedfellows meeting in corridors and antechambers where they might otherwise never meet under other circumstances.
And it's interesting as well, I mean, by a complete fluke, the US, Jeffrey, are the president of the Security Council, the UN Security Council, this month. So that has allowed them to actually have, you know, as we saw yesterday, Barack Obama calling all world leaders to the UN Security Council chamber to discuss ISIS yesterday, Ebola today. I mean, it's quite a bully pulpit, isn't it?
It is. I think the wild card in all of this is Russia and their veto. And you know, it's what we were talking a moment ago about why the UK is not calling on, is not asking to bomb David Cameron to bomb Syria, because they know that there's no UN mandate and that Russia won't let that happen. And in fact, Obama has spoken very, very harshly about Russia at the UN. By some counts, the harshest rhetoric we've seen about Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union. Clearly, there are serious divisions, and the UN is not patching them up.
Indeed. Let's talk about the more glittering things that happen at the UN. Many of the headlines that have come out so far have focused on the smattering of celebrities to attend this year's gathering. Leonardo DiCaprio has been speaking. Emma Watson also took to the podium this year. Jeffrey, James, before I ask you what you think of celebrities talking about the big issues, let's have a little listen to what Emma Watson had to say on the subject of women's rights.
My life is a sheer privilege because my parents didn't love me less because I was born a daughter. My school did not limit me because I was a girl. My mentors didn't assume that I would go less far because I might give birth to a child one day. These influences were the gender equality ambassadors that made me who I am today.
That was Emma Watson speaking about her campaign, He for She. James Boyes, celebrities in certain circumstances can reach a constituency on some very important issues that politicians can't.
They can indeed. I was talking to some of my students just this week, actually, to be honest, about this very issue, because I asked them, you know, what had you seen in the news this week? And it wasn't, oh, there was a talk and a debate at the UN about these issues. It was, oh, the girl from Harry Potter got up and talked about these issues. So, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, overall, I'm always very, very sceptical about, you know, the likes of Russell Brand getting onto Question Time, because I think it demeans politics in many ways and just makes it a joke and a mockery. But if you take these people and you give them a platform and they talk about things in a serious fashion, then you're absolutely right. The best thing about them is they can take them to a sort of a demographic that ordinary politicians, they can reach the parts others can't reach, use the classic line.
I've lived this, let me just say, you know, as a correspondent for American television for almost 20 years, I have watched this. And, you know, you cannot criticize the UN. That's how the UN gets attention. Angelina Jolie goes to Africa, suddenly American TV networks are following her. Angelina Jolie doesn't go to Africa, Africa doesn't exist on American TV news. It is that simple, the equation.
I hate to say, but in some senses, that works for British newspapers as well. When I was working in Nairobi 2006, 2007, it was, you know, trying to get stories on Darfur was, you know, the foreign pages would
absolutely
take it, but to get to the front, oh, not so sure. Yeah. George Clooney rocks up.
Yep.
Suddenly, it's like, all right, let's get a bit of Clooney.
Leonardo DiCaprio, the voice of climate change suddenly. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is just pure pragmatic public relations. The cameras won't come if we have an earnest conference about climate change, but put Leo up there and suddenly it's on the front page.
And actually, to be fair to, obviously, Emma Watson, Leonardo DiCaprio, George Clooney, and I'd also say Ben Affleck on Congo, these are all people that have actually, you know, learnt about the issues that they're talking about, James Boyes, haven't they? They are not just faces that,
absolutely,
you know, an NGO or a UN agency says, oh, go on, here's this script,
absolutely,
and go and talk.
And I thought what was fascinating listening to Emma Watson there was, you know, you could hear that she wasn't necessarily comfortable in that setting. I thought that you could hear a sort of a nervous energy in her voice, which you don't usually get from people in that celebrity status. So it's great that, you know, they've clearly got something they want to get across, and they realise that by using the celebrity voice, they reach a whole new demographic.
And I would also say, in fairness, you know, you can blame the networks, you can blame the newspapers, but they know what their readers and viewers are paying attention to. And you put something on from Darfur, and you know, nobody clicks on it online, but suddenly you know Ben Affleck goes to Darfur. For, and bang, you get you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Jeffrey Kaufman and James Boyes, we'll leave it there, but thank you both as ever for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monaco 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
In the second half, we're going to be in Bogota. We're going to be reviewing some of the best of the week's new book releases. And we've got a bit of a musical treat. So don't miss that. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the news headlines.
Airstrikes against Islamic State militants have continued, targeting oil refineries under its control in Syria. Raids were carried out by the US, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and it's believed at least 14 IS fighters were killed. France has also carried out airstrikes in Iraq, the first in almost a week, and the day after the murder of a French hostage. US officials have questioned a claim from the Iraqi Prime Minister of an Islamic State plot to attack American subway systems. Haider al-Abadi said it was credible intelligence from captured IS fighters. He also suggested the Paris metro could be a target. Around 300 Syrian refugees have been rescued after their boat got into difficulties in rough seas off the coast of Cyprus. Most of those on board were women and children. President Obama's demanded an increased global response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. He said hundreds of thousands, possibly millions, could die without greater outside intervention. Sierra Leone's announced it's to extend an indefinite quarantine covering another million people. And the US Attorney General Eric Holder's to announce his resignation later today. It's thought he'll step down as soon as a successor has been confirmed. He's one of the longest-serving members of President Obama's cabinet. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. It's 18:32 here in London, 10:32 in Los Angeles. Let's head, though, now to Bogota, where our correspondent Anastasia Maloney is standing by. Anastasia, normally in this slot, you know, we ask you to talk about two or three interesting issues and events happening in your part of the world. Today, though, it's fair to say there is really only one big story, and that's this the publication of the agreement so far between the Colombian government and the FARC rebels.
Yes, that's right. This is an important step because so far the two sides have been discussing a possible peace process in Havana for nearly 2 years. And there's been a lot of criticism, both by supporters of the peace process and opposition politicians, that it's too secret. They simply don't know what the two sides are discussing. And the fact that they say that there needs to be more transparency, too much is being done behind closed doors. So I think the decision by the two sides to release what has been agreed so far, the actual documents, what they have signed and agreed upon so far, is an important step. And it's really in response to criticism that Colombians want to know much more about what's going on in Havana.
So the government has released these. They've put them online on a special website. Do you, obviously, it's been covered enormously throughout the country, but are you picking up that actually many ordinary Colombians are going online and reading it for themselves?
I don't know how many Colombians have actually done that, but if they haven't gone direct to the website, they will certainly have heard about it on the radio and the TV, which is the headline news still. The thing is, their documents don't actually reveal a lot that wasn't already known about the agreements. It just goes into a bit more detail about each point they've agreed on. So the two sides have so far agreed on land reform, the political participation of the FARC rebels in the future if a peace deal is signed, and the drug trade. But the documents released give just a bit more detail about that, but they don't really reveal anything that new.
It's a tricky balance to strike, isn't it, Anastasia? Because, you know, on the one hand, obviously, you know, it's a democratic government that wants to be as open as possible and there should be a degree of transparency. But on the other hand, it's very, very hard to strike a proper peace agreement if everything is out in the open. And the fact that they're having it in Havana, a city where, let's face it, it's quite hard to, you can't just send a journalist in to find out what's going on, has certainly lent these proceedings a degree of secrecy that perhaps helps the two sides get on a bit better.
Well, that's right. Well, that was precisely the argument, the discourse of President Juan Manuel Santos, the Colombian president. And he said that, you know, these peace talks have failed in the past because there had been a media circus and too much knowledge about what's going on. And he was very adamant from the get-go that these should be kept under secrecy and behind closed doors. But information has been leaked about it, and there's been so much speculation about really what's going on. And he had to really address the concerns of opposition politicians who said, look, you know, we fear that you're giving too much impunity to the FARC rebels, and Colombians deserve and have the right to know what's going on. So I think after almost 2 years, he's kind of caved into the idea that perhaps to get more Colombians supportive and on board the peace process, he needed to do this.
As you say, it's been nearly 2 years. There were some hopes. Indeed, President Santos set a deadline of November last year. We're some way away from that. Have new deadlines been set? Is there any sense of when this might come to an end?
There isn't any sense of when this might come to an end, but it's fair to say that there's many more months ahead, because they've still got two more very important points to discuss. One, which is the ceasefire. Is there going to be one? How, in fact, are the FARC going to lay down their weapons and demobilize? And also what's called a definitive end to the conflict. Who's going to verify it and handing in the weapons? So they've still got that to sort out. And Santos today did send a very optimistic message today when he spoke to the UN Council in New York today. And he said that, you know, Colombia hopes to give good news to the international community very soon about the peace process, and that they've never advanced so far, so much in any peace talks in Colombia in the future. So Santos continues to be very upbeat and very optimistic about these peace talks. Most people say that some sort of a deal will be signed eventually, but no one's willing to bet exactly when that might be.
Anastasia Maloney, Monocle's Bogota correspondent, thank you. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Up next, we'll have a bit of music, but first we'll meet the author Nick Hayes on his new graphic novel, Woody Guthrie and the Dust Bowl Ballads.
What do you need to build a better city? Tech-savvy urban app builders, hipsters, will take a neglected hood and fill it with quality coffee stores and too many beards. A mayor who's a hard hitter and crack-free, or perhaps some oddballs to liven things up and keep the world a little less well-behaved. On our show, The Urbanist, we've met them all, and many more extraordinary and ordinary people besides, who form the chorus for a good city show.
If all we build is concrete and glass boxes with nothing really cool in between them, it's not as interesting or sustainable or valid a place to live as we're used to. So we got to get back to that thinking.
This one-hour program looks at all the key urban debates, from density to smart cities, but it's not a talking shop for those who think they know best. The Urbanist makes the city human, sees the quirks and contradictions that turn a collection of buildings into a place where people actually want to live. Join us each week on the only show about the cities we live in. It's hosted by me, Andrew Tuck, and it premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours. Join us.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for, well, in a moment we'll have a bit of music. but first we'll explain. His songs became anthems for a nation reeling from an economic crash in the 1930s. Now, Woody Guthrie's music, inspired by America's Dust Bowl, is the subject of a new graphic novel. It chronicles Guthrie's life and lyrics, and I'm very pleased to say that its author, Nick Hayes, joins me now in studio. Nick, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Talk us through this book, because, first of all, why a graphic novel? There are certain stories that really lend themselves to the graphic novel. What is it about Woody Guthrie's life that that made you think that this form fits for him?
Well, I'm not sure it actually happened that way. As soon as I came to drawing all of the music scenes, I was pretty much confronted with the issue of having to draw music, which was so maybe, you know, maybe prose would have just worked better to evoke something like that.
But Don't talk it down.
I could draw, so it was just easier to, you know. I think there's something great about graphic novels that you can leave a lot unsaid. You can sort of leave out some of the dogma or the judgment. If you're dealing with some pretty serious social issues, or some pretty black and white these days social issues, you know, the Okies, as they were called, but, you know, that's really people from about four or five states of America that had sort of were pushed, really, or sort of lured to California. You really don't have to make judgment sentences or, you know, any sorts of statements about their conditions, because you can really just present it. You can read the research, and you don't have to say that they lived in damp conditions. You just have to draw a couple of puddles, and, you know, these things sort of work on a reader, not on a subconscious, but just on a subtle level to get your point across.
Why Woody Guthrie? Why did you feel that his story needed to be told again right now?
Well, again, it wasn't so much his story. I think I have a bit of a issue of trying to suggest that I'm trying to define someone's life. Like, I really wouldn't want someone to do that to me. And luckily, you know, I don't stand much of a chance at that. I think what I wanted to do, I wanted to use his eyes and his ethics as a means of looking at a particular moment in American culture that is not only, you know, sort of directly mirrors ours right now in terms of the economic conditions, in terms of the 99% versus the 1%, in terms of the sort of inherent inequalities between, you know, the ruling elite and, you know, the people.
And that's it. I mean, there is, you know, despite the fact that this was, you know, in the 30s and the 40s that, you know, he was, you know, most famous and most relevant, a lot of his songs, a lot of his lyrics do still have, you know, a great deal of relevance right now.
Yeah, again, I think his lyrics, I mean, what he did, I mean, he's a folk musician, so the sort of concept of them being his lyrics is a sort of looser idea in folk music, because he folk music is for magpies, and in the world of magpies, you're allowed to steal and adapt, and, you know, folk song is open source software. You're allowed to do what you like with them, basically. So a lot of his lyrics were just, you know, he came up with On the Hoof whilst forgetting the songs of the actual, or the lyrics of the actual songs. Yeah, so he was someone that is still very relevant today, I think, just in terms of whom he spoke for.
Now, we have a band over the corridor in Studio 2, and we're going to hear from them in just a moment. But firstly, explain to us why we have a band over in Studio 2.
Well, they're a band of Austrians, a merry band of Austrians. They're my friends from... I sort of grew up going to Austria. I went to draw the lion's share of the book in Austria, and I met these guys in a smoky jazz bar. They play every Thursday, more sort of gypsy jazz, but this is a three of them have sort of banded off, and they've got their own thing going now, and I personally think it's awesome.
And they were quite inspirational for you while you were writing this book?
In a huge way. More, I mean, you know, to do with friendship as well. Like, they were, I was on my own in another country, and I really found some brothers there. So that was cool. But they just, they're musicians of the old order. They're incredibly good at what they do, and they can pick up an instrument at any time and wow anybody with it.
Well, let's see if they can do that right now. Let's cross over to Studio 2 right now to speak to some of the members of Tribi Dabo. Simon Reithhofer on guitar, I believe you're standing by. Hello. Simon, welcome to Midori House. Can you introduce us to your bandmates and explain to us what instruments they're playing first?
Our name is Tribi Dabo. We're from Austria, as you heard. We have on saxophone Matthias Meister. He plays soprano saxophone today. We have an accordion player named Bernhard Kohlhofer. And yeah, I play the guitar.
Excellent. So saxophone, accordion and guitar.
Yeah.
Lovely. You're going to play us a couple of songs. Let's hear the first one. Tell us what it is and then take it away.
It is Odessa Bulgar. It's an klezmer classic. That it is.
Bravo. Fantastic. Thank you very much, Tribi Dabo. Remind us the name of that song?
Odessa Bulgar.
Odessa Bulgar. Right, we will be back with you in just a quick moment. Nick Hayes, finally. I must say, the music I use to write to is sort of, you know, quite slow, quite gentle, allows me to think. You must have been drawing at quite a pace with that in the background.
Well, when I went to the bars, it was more about drinking a Verna Sours. And I did try and do a bit of Hemingway, Orwell, jazz writing, sort of drunk writing in front of them. But
No, it was more about the spirit of it, really, I think. I mean, this is just folk music, just from a different part of the world, really.
Indeed. Well, look, Nick Hayes, thank you very much for coming in. The book is Woody Guthrie and the Dust Bowl Ballads. It's out right now.
Could I briefly interrupt to say that we are playing at Map Studio Cafes in Kentish Town tonight. And tomorrow there's a Facebook thing under the Woody Guthrie launch party where the guys will be playing for about an hour and a half.
Well, there you are.
So do come along if you like it.
If you're in London, do come along to that. Nick Hayes, thank you very much. And Simon, are you still there?
Yeah.
Lovely. Can we have one more?
Yeah, the next one is an own composition. It's called Baalish.
Take it away.
Thank you.
Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House, bit like music. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? We're going to end now with our daily arts review. Today, it's books, and we're joined by Fleur MacDonald, editor of The Omnivore. Fleur, welcome to Midori House.
Hi there.
You were saying just as you came in, you wish you brought your fiddle, but you don't actually play fiddle.
I don't, and even if I did, I don't think I'd keep it in my back pocket.
Okay, no, fair enough. Now, you've got a whole collection of books that you wanted to talk about. Let's start with The Dog by Joseph O'Neill, which is the only one out of these three which I've actually read myself so far. But it's got a place on the Man Booker Prize long list. Joseph O'Neill, of course, did Netherland, but this is very, very different, isn't it?
Well, I haven't read Netherland, so maybe you could tell me.
Very different, very different.
But it will. It was on the long list, but sadly it's no longer on the short list, so it didn't make it to the final six. So it's about a lawyer that decides to move to Dubai because he gets a job offer from one of his old friends. And he's basically running away from New York because he's broken up with his girlfriend. And he moves to Dubai for a new start. He's quite a difficult character.
He is, isn't he? Because he's a lawyer and he speaks as a lawyer, doesn't he?
Lawyers speak like that?
Well, no, but as in he speaks in legalese. It's got that. No, obviously lawyers don't speak like that, but reading it is almost like you're reading a legal document.
Yeah, I mean, or a legal document or a parody of a legal document. So you have that for the whole entirety of the book, which is quite wearing, but then that's meant to be the point of it, I suppose. You're meant to, it's meant to produce the same disaffection that he feels in the reader, which is quite a difficult thing to pull off.
And yet, I mean, I'd argue that he does pull that off, and it is, you get a real sense of Dubai and the sort of the soullessness of it.
Yeah, I suppose Dubai is one of those, I mean, it's one of the only places in the world that everybody's nasty about, and we're allowed to be nasty about Dubai. And he does get out all of the cliches about Dubai, so the constructions that are never finished, the huge wealth and waste, the fact that half of the population are expats and they don't have any dealing with the ordinary population, etc., etc. But it is really funny.
It is indeed. Let's talk briefly about two books by celebrated British authors that have just come out. The Children Act by Ian McEwan and The Assassination of Margaret Thatcher by Hilary Mantel, which is a collection of 10 short stories, of which one is the aforementioned Assassination of Margaret Thatcher. That latter one, Hilary Mantel, has caused a bit of controversy purely for the title and what that first short story suggests, which has been slightly ridiculous, hasn't it?
Yes, I mean, a lot of MPs and people that used to know Margaret Thatcher have got on their high horses. So Nadine Dorries, who's well known for her sensible and thought through opinions, basically said, "I feel sorry for Margaret Thatcher's family." Then some other PR, a person that used to know Margaret Thatcher said, if someone wishes to assassinate someone, then the police should investigate it, which seems utterly ridiculous because she's dead. And I would like to see how Hilary Mantel might try and assassinate Thatcher. But, you know, Hilary Mantel does like to court controversy even. There was that thing in the press about Kate Middleton and calling her an empty vessel. But if you actually read the short story, you realise that it's not really as controversial as all that. I mean, the Telegraph refused to print it, as these people said that they censored it. And I wouldn't say it's because it's a story about assassinating a politician. I would say more it's because she completely reduces Margaret Thatcher. So Margaret Thatcher, the little that you see of her in the short story, is a ridiculous person with stupid glasses, with a fake voice, who's tottering along on her high heels. And as a Thatcher supporter, I would find that far more upsetting.
The key question, is it actually any good?
Well, you can find out yourselves. You don't even need to buy the book. It's on the Guardian website, so you can read it there. And then this was another problem I had with the collection, is that the two first stories in the collection are also for free. You can find one of them on the LRB website, where it was actually published as a memoir rather than a short story. And you can find the other one, I think, on The Guardian
as well. So why buy the actual book?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And finally, very quickly, Ian McEwan, The Children Act. Is this, do we think, up to some of his early great stuff, or is this of a piece of his more modern stuff?
Yeah, I hate to put a downer on it, but I would go, yeah. It sort of reads like a well-produced kind of BBC drama. So it's a bit like Silk or Judge Deed, and with a bit of kind of the moral questioning that maybe you might listen to on Woman's Hour kind of thrown in as well. So it's very polished. It's basically about a lawyer that has to decide whether to let a young man kill himself because of his faith. And the questions, they're deep, but we've heard it all before on moral maze.
There we are. Fleur MacDonald, editor of The Omnivore, thank you very much indeed. That's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Jeffrey Kaufman, James Boys, Fleur MacDonald, Nick Hayes, and the wonderful band that we heard before, the Tabba Bays. Thanks indeed to Tom Lewis, who produced the show, David Pleasant and Rebecca Unger, who researched it, and our studio manager, who was Bill Lutie. Coming up after the headlines, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. The Monocle Daily is, of course, on at 2200 hours. And tomorrow, at the same time, Midori House, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.